This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, monkeypox is in the news with new cases around the country. A Wisconsin infectious disease expert tells us what it is, how it's treated, and what concerns the disease is raising. Now, violent crime spiked during the pandemic. Homicides in cities went up 30% in 2020, according to CDC data. But this isn't just a problem in cities. It extends to rural parts of the country as well. In 2020, homicide rates in rural America spiked a similar amount, 25%. That's the biggest increase since the CDC started tracking those numbers two decades ago. Our next guest looked at crime in rural communities and the challenges that rural police departments are facing. Zusha Ellenson is a U.S. News reporter for The Wall Street Journal who focuses on crime and guns. Zusha, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Dan Frost is an enterprise reporter for The Wall Street Journal who writes often about crime in the U.S. He's a graduate, by the way, of Beloit College. Dan, welcome back to Wisconsin.
I appreciate it.
Dan, the two of you and a colleague looked at rural homicide around the country. How is the nature of this problem different in rural areas maybe than what we're seeing in urban parts of the country?
Well, it's a good question. In urban areas over the past few years, we've seen sort of an acceleration of the classic gang and drug-related crime fueled by gun violence. But in rural areas, it's much harder to pinpoint why we've seen homicides increase. You don't have sort of the traditional organized gangs jockeying for turf. You don't have other sort of criminal enterprises the same way that you do in cities. And so what we found was that sort of the traditional community ties and rituals that have bound small communities and rural towns together for many years were really overturned during the pandemic. And in some form or fashion, that contributed to the rise in homicides in these areas.
And Zusha, rural law enforcement doesn't always have resources that police and cities have, very small staffs. What did you find looking at how police departments are dealing with these increases in homicides?
Yeah, I mean, this was a really troubling time for these little police departments and sheriff's offices across the West and in the South and in these small towns. A lot of them cover counties that are as big as states like Connecticut with a handful of deputies. So they're driving an hour or more to crime scenes. They can't send officers to a particular problem area to patrol. They just have too much space like they can do in cities. So they're really struggling to deal with this surge in violence. They've asked for more deputies. Prosecutors are overwhelmed with cases as well. They're asking for more line prosecutors. It's kind of an intractable problem. Although they're starting to see homicides go down in some areas, and in some areas they're continuing to climb.
Dan, in that piece actually led us to give you a call, you and your colleagues looked at you know, some particular towns and got firsthand reports from sheriffs and community members and others. How did they talk about this? It seemed, first of all, they were very surprised to see this increase.
Yeah, I mean, you're dealing with areas that typically would see maybe one homicide a year. Oftentimes they'd go several years without seeing a homicide, and then suddenly they're seeing five, six, seven, you know, in double digits. And so I think it was not only quite shocking to community members, law enforcement, prosecutors who were not used to investigating this number of homicides, if any homicides at all, but also the level of violence that they were seeing. It wasn't something that they had seen before. It was an extreme level of violence. And, one of the prosecutors that we spoke to from rural Arkansas basically made it seem like in her area that everyone had essentially just sort of lost their minds during COVID. And so pretty much everybody to a T we spoke to in these rural communities were stunned at not only the number of homicides they were seeing, but the level of violence they were seeing as well.
And Zusha, it occurs to me that, you know, for a city's going to have one or more newspapers. It's going to have local TV stations, lots of maybe of news radio, too. These smaller communities we're talking about may not have that local media outlet. Is that keeping this kind of an invisible problem in the country in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, as we set out to investigate this, we looked at the federal data, and that's really what led us to this story. This is really an untold story about violence in America. I mean, we've thought of rural areas as the safest place in America for decades, right? That's the place where you go if you want to get away from the big cities. That's the place where you know your neighbors, where you can keep your doors unlocked, where you can keep your keys in your cars. But what we've seen in doing these stories is that, you know, behavior is changing in these small communities after the rise in violence. A lot of people said, as cliche as it sounds, that they've locked their doors for the first time. We talked to people who lived in the mountain, you know, these mountainous region in Montana, these, you know, very strong, tough guys who, you know, work on ranches, construction workers. And they said, you know, I've never been afraid in my life before. And now I'm locking my front door.
We're talking to Zusha Ellenson and Dan Frosch from The Wall Street Journal. They looked into an increase in crime and violent crime in rural parts of the United States. During the pandemic, rates jumped there almost as much as in urban areas. Dan, is there, because we're dealing with lots of different communities, lots of different crimes, is there a common type of situation that leads to homicide? Is it a domestic violence or domestic dispute, or is it hard to say there's a most common type?
I don't know if there was necessarily a most common type, but we did notice sort of several trends. We noticed that disputes between neighbors or acquaintances or people who had some sort of interactions with each other spiraled quickly into violence in these areas. You know, one of the cases we highlighted was a dispute over lawn mowing, which led to a homicide. Another was a sort of disagreement happening at a bar. There was just sort of a randomness to some of these homicides that I think was particularly striking. As I mentioned earlier, it wasn't sort of the traditional tit for tat shootings that you see in urban areas involving drugs or gang activity. There was really sort of an acceleration of emotions that fueled the violence in these areas that I think was sort of an underlying current that we noticed in all the communities we profiled.
And Zusha, in the homicides we're talking about in rural areas, how common, how much of this was gun violence in particular?
Yeah, so a lot of it was gun violence, but we were also surprised to find that especially in a lot of these domestic violence cases, there was a lot of strangulation, stabbings, and these were real crimes of, you know, people call them crimes of passion, people's anger boiling over and using whatever they had there with them to kill the person. So, you know, there was a lot of gun violence, but there was also, I think, more than we expected, other means used.
Dan, are we seeing any kind of response to this, any sort of targeted efforts from federal, state, or local authorities for that matter?
You're seeing law enforcement in rural areas interested and trying to beef up their ranks. I mean, all over the country, we've seen sort of an exodus of officers from police departments, large and small. So it's already a challenge. But some of these rural departments, which are already understaffed and as Zusha pointed out, having to police these large swaths of the country, are recognizing that they may need more officers. So they're trying to hire more. They're also trying to sort of increase their crime forensics capabilities as a way of investigating some of these crimes. But to be honest with you, it's, you know, as one of the sheriffs who I spoke to pointed out, these aren't crimes that can necessarily be prevented in a way that crimes in cities can potentially, where you can sort of focus on a particular area that's high crime and deploy resources to it. Because of the randomness of the violence that these rural areas were seeing, it's really much more reactive on the part of these small rural law enforcement agencies. So it's a tough problem they have on their hands.
And Zusha, as we wrapped up earlier, you mentioned that some of the communities we're talking about in rural areas are seeing this trend reverse some. What are you watching for in the months to come to see if that tends to be more of a trend in more of rural America?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're going to be looking for reports from local sheriffs. We're going to be looking at CDC data coming out. We're going to be looking at FBI data coming out to see if the homicides go down and violent crime goes down. Anecdotally, what we've seen is that in some places it started to ease as sort of the stress and the attendant problems of the pandemic recede. But in some places it's continued. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens.
We'll leave it there, Azusha. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, guys.
And Dan,
thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us. Yeah. Azusha Allenson is a U.S. News reporter for The Wall Street Journal who focuses on gun and crimes. And Dan Frosch is an enterprise reporter at The Journal who writes about crime in the U.S. They talked to us about a spike in violent crime during the pandemic in rural America. Coming up, a Wisconsin infectious disease expert tells us what's going on with monkeypox in the United States. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a neuroscientist tells us about the myth of a normal brain, what makes everyone's brain different, and how to better understand our own minds. Now, the World Health Organization declared monkeypox a global health emergency on July 23rd. The U.S. is approaching 6,000 total cases, 18 of those detected in Wisconsin. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health with expertise in vaccines and immunization policy. He's a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. It's a pleasure to be with you again, especially not talking about COVID.
Right. A change of pace for us here, Dr. Tempty. Now, tell us a little bit about monkeypox. It's caused, I understand, by a virus. Tell us a little bit about this disease.
Well, this is a virus that is closely related to smallpox and some of the other contagious diseases out there. This particular disease was first isolated back in 1958 and was originally found in a colony of research monkeys, so hence the name name monkeypox. In general, though, this is one that has typically been spread by other animals to humans. And in fact, back in 2003, Wisconsin had a small outbreak that was caused primarily by spread from, I believe, prairie dogs to humans. And Wisconsin had more cases than any other state at that time. But I hate to say this, but currently we're up to 22 cases in Wisconsin, and that surpasses what we had back in 2003.
Now, you say smallpox, which I think of as one of the most horrific diseases in human history. Monkeypox, not that bad?
Not that bad. Unfortunately, in this current outbreak, there have now been some deaths reported. And in Africa, where this disease is more common and what we call endemic, the rate of death is somewhere between 1% and 6% of cases. But you have to keep in mind that those are situations where there are many more children exposed.
So tell us a little bit about how we might recognize a case of smallpox. I'm sorry, of monkeypox.
Well, yeah, hopefully we keep it with monkeypox,
right, yes.
Here. That typically the way we recognize this is through fairly obvious skin lesions. These tend to be larger, somewhat rubbery in feel. They start out as a spot. They turn into a lump, turn into what we call a vesicle or a fluid-filled lesion. These will eventually either burst or resolve, get replaced by a scab. The scab will come off and be replaced by normal skin. And this might take anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks to go through that. Unfortunately, early on, the first symptoms are very, very, you know, non-definitive. They tend to be fever, fatigue, sore muscles, sore back, and so on. But typically, about anywhere from a day to 3 days after these initial symptoms, we tend to see this rash coming on.
Now, how contagious is monkeypox?
Well, I tend to tell people that if you're a human being with skin and mucous membranes, there's a possibility of becoming infected. But it's not highly contagious. We know from some studies that the rate of transmission within a household tends to be less than 10%. And this compares to things like COVID, which might be as high as 40 to 70% transmissibility within a household. So the good news is it's not as transmissible, but it is transmissible. What it takes, though, basically is skin-to-skin contact. And there's some evidence emerging that there is, the potential for sexual transmission as well.
Talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty with UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the disease monkeypox, some cases now here in Wisconsin and around the U.S. Dr. Tempty, vaccines, what kind of vaccine options are out there? Are they available?
Absolutely. And the good news is there are two vaccines that are already licensed by the FDA. They were both developed primarily for a smallpox response. And fortunately, we haven't had that situation at all. But because they are in the same family, they also appear to cover for monkeypox as well. One is called ACAM2000, which is a live virus vaccine, requires one dose. The other is Jynneos, and it is a vaccine that is a live virus but does not replicate or reproduce in you. And that one requires two doses about 28 days apart. But both of these are licensed. They are available, but only in limited supplies. And so these aren't available for anybody who wants them. We tend to provide them to people who are at high risk or have had exposure.
Who is at high risk? Who might be first in line for that kind of vaccine?
Well, currently the state of Wisconsin has three criteria. First, people who have a sexual partner who has been diagnosed with monkeypox in the last 14 days. The second group are people who have attended an event where there was known monkeypox exposure. And the third would be for individuals who are gay, bisexual, transgender, or men who have sex with men and have had multiple partners in the last 14 days. And I bring this up because this is a vaccine. If we provide it within 4 days of exposure, you can actually prevent the monkeypox. So this is something we call post-exposure prophylaxis. It also is something that people in the future can be vaccinated against, for prevention. One of the other factors out there, and I just say this with a little trepidation, but for those of us who are age 55 and older, we probably got the smallpox vaccine as children. You can check by looking for the donut-shaped scar on your upper arm. And there probably is some protection for some of us older folks out there who have previously received the smallpox vaccine.
Now, when COVID-19 came about, it was a coronavirus. It was related to diseases we had seen before, but basically this is a first time thing for humans. Monkeypox is different, right? This is a new outbreak of a disease we've known about for some time.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, we've known about this disease since 1958, so almost 65 years. And it has largely been confined in two areas of Africa. There is a Central Africa and a Western Africa strain of this virus. But the concern right now is it has jumped out of the traditional area and has really exploded across the globe right now. There are over 80 countries that have cases and almost 24,000 known cases out there across the world. And because of this, the World Health Organization has labeled this a public health emergency of international concern.
What about treatment? Are there available, antiviral medications that can reduce the damage of this illness?
Well, there are antiviral agents that are effective against some of the cousins of this virus. We don't have anything that is officially labeled or indicated for monkeypox, but there are agents out there that we think will be helpful. And these, again, are aimed particularly at people who are at high risk for bad outcomes. individuals with immunosuppression or other reasons that a skin infection could really cause a lot of harm.
For parents, Dr. Temte, who might be watchful for chicken pox for their kids, is there an easy way to tell the difference and say, oh yeah, get to the doctor sooner than later?
Well, I think the main thing is, fortunately, chicken pox has been rendered a relatively rare disease in the United States because of very, very effective vaccines that we give in childhood. And so chicken pox in my career has gone from a very, very common illness to one which is now reportable to the state when we see it, because it is relatively rare. But chicken pox tends to be much smaller lesions. I tend to tell people that they're the size of a, corn kernel or less in size. The monkeypox tends to be a little bit larger than that, more anywhere from that size up to a dime or quarter size. And at this point in time, we're seeing most of the cases of monkeypox in adults, whereas there have been a couple cases reported in children, most of the cases are in adults.
Dr. Temte, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
And thank you so much, helping to get the word out.
That's Dr. Jonathan Temte, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, also professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. He joined us today for a look at monkeypox, declared a global health emergency now, as we heard, by the World Health Organization. We're watching numbers in Wisconsin and around the country. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a look at board games and the people who play them. This with two Wisconsin game designers. So that's my kind of conversation. You can join in. Maybe I will too. And you can get started right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. Do you have a favorite board game to play with family, with friends, with enemies? Email ideas@wpr.org with your board game favorites. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes after reading a lot of words and saying a lot of words in my life, I still learn new things about words. Here's one, the word chicane. That's C-H-I-C-A-N-E. Now, this came up because my daughter has been calling the split between I-90 and I-94 by Toma a chicane. It isn't, really. She watches Formula One. She knows it's actually a serious curve in a road often used in racing. But I learned something new when I looked it up. There's an older meaning from card games, where a chicane is an absence of trump cards in your hand of cards. Now, and that's bad, by the way, if you don't play these games. You want those cards. I play Pinochle a lot. I play online with my parents every week. Sad to say, with my luck, I often have what I now know is a chicane. And by the way, if I figure out how to hack into the card game server and give myself better cards, I would be engaging in a related word, chicanery. Lots of twists and turns. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Have you ever wondered if your brain is normal as brains go? Maybe you're usually one of the last people to finish a test, or you get stressed out about going to parties, or insert your personal quirk here. Our next guest says thinking about our brains as normal or not normal is really oversimplifying things. She studied neuroscience for years and says every brain is different and constantly being shaped by its own specific environment. She's also got some tools to help us better understand how our own brains work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how brains work? What makes one person different from another? What the different pieces of our brains do? And are there kind of tasks that you think you're really good at or others that you struggle with that set you apart from other people? You wonder why that is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Chantel Pratt is a psychologist and neuroscientist at the University of Washington. Her new book out today is The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Chantel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm really looking forward to learning with your listeners and to talking to you.
All right. Now, I know one way I think about my brain is wrong. And let's get this out of the way right out front. You know, I assume that there's this reality out there and my brain is this, you know, camera and listening device. And it's just showing me what's really out there. In fact, it's a little more complicated, right? Our brain is this interpretive storyteller. You write about this in your book.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, I like to start out with a really safe example, which was the dress that took the internet by storm because people couldn't agree about whether it was blue or black and white or white and gold. And I think the reason that captivated so many people is that the storytelling of your brain is so convincing, right?
Yeah, definitely. And so what is going on? Let's run with that example. Why might I see a dress as one color and somebody else see it as another, but it's the same image?
Right. So most of us learned at some point in our lives that color, something as elementary as color, has a straightforward mapping to physical energy in the world, right? You learned at some point that, you know, slower waves are red, yellow, red, orange end of the rainbow, and the faster light waves are at the blue, indigo end of the rainbow, and that you have these cones in the back of your eye that absorb light at different wavelengths and send signals to your brain telling you what color you see. It feels very one-to-one mapping in terms of the physical energy in the world and the things that you see. But if it were like that, then we would all see things changing color all the time as the property of the light around us changed. So a green apple would turn red in the sunset and blue in a shadow. Instead, our brains learn over time that the light bouncing off things is more likely to change than the color of an object itself. So something as elementary as color vision is still really inferential in your brain. Your brain takes a sample of all the context around an object and decides based on its relative light waves that are bouncing off of that thing, what color it is. And when people see the dress, well, let me just say that the thing that makes the dress ambiguous and interesting is that there isn't a lot of context in it. It's just a picture of kind of the torso of some person. And so there, your brain guesses, where's the light? What's going on around this thing? It doesn't have a lot of context. And people who see the dress as white and gold, their brains have automatically and instantly assumed that there's light coming from behind the dress and that it's in a shadow. So they subtract the blue and black hues that actually make up the dress. They subtract it right out of the picture, and the person perceives white and gold.
And that's just Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say why, you know, we know a little bit. Some interesting experiments have given us some suggestions about why I might make a different assumption than you about the lighting. And for instance, a small percentage of what makes people see one thing or the other relates to how much time you spend in natural versus overhead lighting. And so people who are larks or wake up early in the morning and are more likely to spend time in naturally lit environments are more likely to see the dress as white and gold, are more likely to think it's in a shadow. And people who are night owls and so spend more time awake after dark are more likely to see the dress as blue and black, to assume the lighting is coming from straight overhead. This is just a little example of how our thousands and thousands of experiences with light shape the way our brain interprets the world around us.
And you write that there's a lot of research and writing about brains in general, on average, and you make the case that each of our brains is really unique, and there are zillions of examples like the dress of how there's variation from me to you to whoever.
Right. Yes. And I think that, you know, the idea of normal as I think that many of us think that when we say something is normal, especially when it comes to a brain function, we're pointing to a single ideal, like a template. But in fact, we can't even define normal unless we understand the ways that people vary. And so normal in reality is this multidimensional space. There are lots of different axes on which brains are different. And in this space, there's a lot of room for brains to work differently and not be better or worse suited for functioning, just different.
talking to Chantal Pratt about her new book. It's called The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about our brains and how they may differ from one person to another and how we read, interpret the world around us. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I want to share that, you know, years ago in my 20s, I volunteered in a drug and alcohol treatment center. And the professionals there loved my insights and the intuition that I wrote in the treatment papers and notes. And we had, during a treatment meeting, they said, Jeff, what's your secret for being such a good listener? And I used the phrase that I sit 3 feet behind my head. So I'm able to be detached, but I'm engaged, and I don't let my emotions lead me to my next thought. And I was able to observe and be very productive in terms of helping the clients in their recovery. I enjoyed it.
Jeff, thanks for that call and for sharing that story. And Chantal, two things there. Something is making Jeff a good listener, but he also talked about kind of being aware of his own brain and taking a position a few feet behind it in a way to help make him a good listener. What does that make you think about?
I think that is fascinating, and how wonderful that your brain landed on that strategy for you. Because in fact, in the book, I talk about one of the things that gets in the way of us understanding, especially people who work differently from us, is that our most natural way of connecting with others is to mirror them or to simulate using what has been called mirror neurons, the way your brain, the state your brain would be in if you were behaving this way. This is our instinct. This is what babies do when they observe the actions of others. Their brains say, oh, I see a hand moving. This is the motor program that I would need to do to move that hand. And it kind of puts you in an internal state that is similar to, ideally, it's similar to the person you're observing. Through this, when things go well, you experience empathy. And like, for instance, if you see someone in pain and you feel pain, that's what's going on. But social neuroscientists are finding out more and more that we tend to hang out with people whose brains work just like ours do. So this kind of mirroring works really well when we have people with lots of shared experiences and similar brains that work similar ways. So what the caller's, you know, his brain seemed to be doing was, let me take a step out of my perspective and just observe this person for what they are and try and understand that person sort of separate from this brain behind the eyes. And I think that's brilliant. I mean, what I'm hoping to do is to give people some concrete examples about these different ways that people work so they can have a tool belt with which to draw upon if somebody is not behaving the way you think you would behave if you were in that situation.
Thanks for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to neuroscientist Chantal Pratt from the University of Washington. Her new book is out today. It's called The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you noticed about the way your own brain works? Do you feel like in some key way your brain works differently than the people around you? What is that? Why is it, do you think? Or do you have a question about why that might be? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the new book, The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Chantal Pratt with the University of Washington stays with us, a neuroscientist and psychologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, maybe your observations about how your own brain works. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Lori is with us in Stevens Point. Lori, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, my question is, as we go through life, does your thought process and assessments change based on experiences of like trauma, or if you're heavy being an empath, or just how do those experiences alter how your brain functions?
Lori, thanks. A great question, Chantal. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot in there. I mean, I think you can probably intuit if you think about how your brain worked when you were a teenager, or even how your brain works in the morning and the evening, that it does change. It changes with experience. It changes with the sort of neurochemical weather that changes across the day and depending on what you eat. Things like trauma or, you know, experiencing empathy, sort of connecting with others and their emotions have different effects on different brains. And it really depends on what was already happening. What is the chemical and connectivity, the sort of the weather is the best. I don't know why that metaphor popped into my head, but what was already going on when those things happen? So do our brains change with experience? Absolutely. My brain has already changed in the conversations that we're having. The question is, how noticeable will that be, or how impactful will that be? And that really depends on the experience. Now, one thing I can tell you is that part of that experience is the original event. And another part of that experience is your re-experiencing of that event. So if you rehearse the event, or if you tell yourself a story about the event, you know, like, I might be behaving this way because of X, those things can re-affect your brain. In fact, not only can they do. So every time you think about an event, the emotions that you're experiencing, the sort of neural weather, so to speak, they get laid down in the memory trace in the way that shapes your brain.
Thanks a lot for that call, Lori, at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now in Cornell. Tom, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Tom?
Well, you know, I've got my son. He was actually born in the Philippines. He's only been in America. He was only in America for 8 months in an English-speaking community. But at less than 20 months old, he actually taught himself how to read. He could barely speak English at this point, but was already reading words like book, said, you know, father, mother, stuff like that. Now he's 2.5 now. He's able to sound out words like stegosaurus, you know,
wow,
like just dictionary, you know, crazy big words that a 2.5-year-old shouldn't know. And he's good at everything. He's doing addition already, math, subtraction, puzzles. But
Tom,
yeah,
thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I remember in my early days of parenting, Chantel, I could freak myself out like, oh, my kid isn't at this stage now, or maybe they're ahead here, but behind there. Those things are going to happen at different paces for different kids, partly because I guess their brains are different.
Mm-hmm. And partly because their experiences are different. So I would say give yourself some credit, Tom, because you can't actually learn to read without some input. You can leave a baby, this I can, you know, put my hand to the flame for. You can leave a baby in a, you know, playpen full of newspaper their whole entire life, and unless somebody points to things and pronounces them, they're never going to pick it up. But I think that the really interesting thing about reading is that it's a relatively new skill that our brains have developed. Unlike spoken language, which kids pick up in the water, so to speak, right? Like almost every active brain will learn a language if it's exposed to it. Reading is something that needs thousands of hours of practice. So I would say it's a combination of, yes, the way your child's brain is built and the inputs that they've had that also probably allow them to love this game. You know, you said Stegosaurus. This is so cool. And when they feel like rewarded from the adults around them, and when they're good at something, you get this kind of a Matthew effect where the rich get richer. And I think we just need to be aware of this as parents too. If we are subconsciously worrying about our kids being delayed, and are we saying those kind of things around them, and are we treating them differently? Because the reverse can also happen. If you think, oh, they're struggling, or you make it not fun, you have a concerned face, you can have the opposite effect as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. Talking to neuroscientist Chantel Pratt about her new book, The Neuroscience of You. Back to your calls now with Pat in Green Bay. Pat, what's on your mind?
I just got a real quick question. How does it come about that some of us end up with learning disabilities? There's just certain things that I can memorize, but there are other things I love, but I can't wrap my head around it. Being able to remember certain things.
Pat, thanks for the call, Chantel. Pat, definitely not alone.
Yes, that's right. And I think that, you know, what the research that I and others have been doing, I think one really important message is that some of the things that we consider a disability, and I'm doing air quotes here that you can't see, are people who struggle in traditional learning environments. And I think that when you're saying like some things I can learn and other things I can't, I would just ask you to hold in mind that your brain has been evolving, not your individual brain has been evolving through your lifespan, but human brains have been evolving for a very, very long time. And the kinds of things that we ask them to do right now are not perfectly characteristic of the kinds of things that our ancestors asked their brains to do. And unfortunately, I think that our education system is built on the one-size-fits-all approach to neuroscience and assumes it sort of caters to the way that the majority of people learn or the way that we think people should learn. And my hope is that if we understand the spaces of brain differences and we understand what is it that makes learning some things easier for you than others, what is the information processing characteristic of that particular task that makes it easy for you, how can we create, instead of saying this brain is disabled or this brain has a problem learning here, can we use this information to create optimal learning environments for each brain?
Pat, thanks a lot for that call. Chantel, a big point of your book is encouraging us to use our brains to think about our brains, which is, I don't know, kind of a paradoxical or something in that neighborhood. But how can we get started on that path? What kind of things can we do to look at the way, think about the way we think, and then what do we do with it?
So it was really cute. My daughter, who's 27, made a post on social media yesterday, and it said, "Can you even know yourself if you don't know how your brain works?" And I would argue no. So mostly because, you know, we talked about the dress and how shocking it was. I just think that we have an artificially inflated sense of confidence most of the time about the way we understand the world. You know, we have, like you said, the reality that our brain creates is so convincing that we don't understand all of the interpretation that goes into that. So if you want to really understand yourself and understand how your brain might be perceiving the same environment differently from someone else, I'd encourage you to read the book or go to my website, Chantel Pratt, ChantelPratt.com. On the research tab, you can play some games that will give you feedback instantly about some of the different ways that brains work and even point you to the research so you can learn more.
I want to tease one more thing. I read in your book, Chantel, some people, like this is me, have an internal monologue that is words, and some people don't. And I can't comprehend not, and I imagine it's the same going the other way. What's going on with that?
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I kept thinking if I was listening to your show, that's what I would call in and say. My husband, I just so happened to be married to a person who thinks in what he calls consciousness Netflix on mute. So I have a little bit of insight into this because it boggles the mind. So many people who think in pictures just assume that everybody thinks in pictures. And when they see these internal monologues playing out in movies or stories, they think it's just artistic license for how to explain what's going on in someone's mind. And vice versa, the majority of people, although we don't have good science to actually tell us what proportion, think in a sort of, you know, verbal monologue. I not only do I think this way, I, you know, I talk to plants and so forth and so on. I'm highly verbal. I'm predisposed to code the world verbally. And what I suspect is happening based on a tidbit of research on the way people represent information is that some of our brains are just set up to distinguish things better visually, and others are just set up to distinguish things better verbally. Now, there are a whole bunch of different environments in which one or the other thing would work better. But if your brain works one way, Like, I have done tasks where you're supposed to be remembering non-nameable things, like a fractal. My brain will still try and name it. I'm like, that's the seven looking thing. That's the this looking thing. And it does. I do terrible. Like, if I would just be quiet and try and look at the thing, I would remember better. But because my brain is set up this way, it tries to organize the world according to semantics and verbal labels. I think it's easier. It must be something about my brain that makes that easier. And so that's the code I use to think to myself.
We'll leave it there. Chantal, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's neuroscientist Chantal Pratt. Her new book is out today. It's called The Neuroscience of You, How Every Brain is Different and How to Understand Yours. Keep sharing your stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org.